the UK government has abandoned plans to create a working definition of Islamophobia in a move which has come under heavy fire from critics. Back in May 2019, the then government headed by Theresa May agreed it would seek to establish an Islamophobia definition to get a firmer grip of this bigotry and division. But following mounting frustration over a lack of progress on the issue, the effort has now been reportedly ditched.
The news is hardly surprising, as May's successor, Boris Johnson, has been faulted many times over for saying Islamophobic things, whilst other Tory ministers have also been accused of being deeply Islamophobic themselves.
Reappointed Communities Secretary Michael Gove has been a long-time critic of so-called political Islam, and condemned attempts to define Islamophobia as a danger for free speech.
Michael Gove, while he was at Policy Exchange, was very much supportive of anything which, as far as he was concerned, outed Islam. He calls it political Islam. But actually, in reality, it's a phobia which these folk have about any kind of Muslim. When you look at and compare it to how they deal with anti-Semitism, and they're so absolutely hell-bent on definitions, on laws, on rooting out, on chasing, hunting down, witch-hunting anybody who even sniffs the idea of something to do with Jewry, or even say the J word, or even to raise the issue of Zionism, for instance, or to criticise Israel. As soon as you do these things, as far as these neoconservatives are concerned, you are enemy number one.
Islamophobia is a serious problem across Britain. Muslims being the most frequently targeted group for religious hate crimes in England and Wales. Defining Islamophobia could provide new powers to combat anti-Muslim hate. But with a string of scandals having exposed anti-Muslim bigotry within the ruling party itself, Conservatives just don't seem willing to risk shooting themselves in the foot on the issue. Robert Carter, London.
In a narrow alley in the Itaewon Entertainment District of Seoul, more than 150 people suffocated and died in the crush of a crowd on a Halloween Saturday evening. 26 of them were foreigners. Five of those were Iranian, the most of any foreign nationals, exchange students in their 20s and 30s. This week, the lives lost in the Itaewon tragedy are being mourned with white chrysanthemums and black ribbons. And as the investigation into what happened begins, tough questions are being asked of the government and of the police about what more could have been done to prevent such a disaster. As video and news of the event has circulated in both mass and social media, frustration at the response of the government and police has swelled.
Our country is not even at war. Whose fault is it for this to happen? Why were they so careless? Where were the police? This tragedy wouldn't have happened if the police had controlled traffic with a little effort. What are you going to do after killing all those young people?
South Korean Prime Minister Han Duck-soo appeared before the Foreign Press Tuesday. He suggested South Korea was still one of the safest countries in the world and that preparations were inadequate in part because the event was not registered. But he admitted some failures.
The real issue was some deficiencies in our crowd management. That kind of deficiencies in our system should have been corrected long before, but it's a reality that it hasn't been done, and at least we should not pass that away again.
The Itaewon tragedy is South Korea's worst disaster since 2014. When a ferry sank, killing 304 people, most of them students on a field trip. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A group of Iranians, among them war veterans, gathered in front of the German embassy in Tehran to protest against the German government for what they called Berlin's role in the recent riots in Iran. The protesters, including ordinary people and veterans of the 8-year Iraqi-imposed war on Iran in the 1980s, carried placards and chanted slogans against the German government for its record of supporting former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and its role in the recent unrest in Iran.
A number of my comrades and friends became handicapped, and some were martyred in the war because of the enemy's chemical attacks. Documents that have been released reveal that Germany had provided Saddam with raw materials for chemical bombs. Therefore, we are to say that we do not allow Germany to interfere in the internal affairs of our country anymore. We hold Germany responsible for instigating unrest in Iran.
The demonstrators also vented their anger on the German chancellor and foreign minister.
I am taking part in this protest gathering to condemn the German government for its interventionist stance towards Iranian affairs. We know that Germany and other EU member states, by supporting riots and unrest in Iran, are only after their own vested interests, and they do not truly care about Iranian people.
On Monday, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman criticized Germany for its unconstructive initiative to classify the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps as a terrorist organization. Condemning Germany's move as an irresponsible measure, Nasser Kanani said Tehran hopes that the government of Germany and other governments would take account of the outcome of their unconstructive measures.
Iranian officials believe that repeating such an approach by Germany and other EU member states towards Iran, which is based on miscalculations and misinformation, will once again expose the Union to failure. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted the leaders of Armenia and Azerbaijan in an attempt to help the two ex-Soviet states settle their long-standing conflict. Putin said he's hopeful that the summit will make it possible to outline steps to resolve the Nagorno-Karabakh issue, adding the Armenian leadership has the political will to resolve the conflict with Azerbaijan. Putin, however, noted Moscow does not impose anything on anyone and only offers a peaceful solution.
I know that you have the political will for this, and we support it in every possible way. We must find the key points that will allow us to move forward. This conflict has been going on for decades, so we still need to end it sometime.
Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan reacted to Putin's remarks, voicing his readiness to accept Moscow's offer to establish diplomatic relations with Baku. Azerbaijan President Ilham Aliyev also said that the Karabakh conflict has already become history and it is time to talk about the normalization of relations between Yerevan and Baku. He expressed gratitude to Russia for trying to resolve the issue. Some experts believe the U.S. and some European countries, particularly France, are trying to foment discord between Armenia from Russia, reform their friendly relations to hostility, withdraw Armenia from the CSTO, and encourage Yerevan for a new large-scale military conflict with Azerbaijan.
France is actively intervening in the conflict. NATO's interests are visible behind it. The USA has one of its largest embassies in Yerevan, the same with Azerbaijan. There goes Israel and the UK. The latter is one of Turkey's closest friends. Another block of countries is being formed there, but they all work in the same direction. They are opposed to the participation of Iran and Russia in resolving this conflict and are trying to replace the participation of neighboring states with that of Western ones. This deprives the people of Armenia and Azerbaijan of a peaceful solution.
A six-week war between Azerbaijan and Armenia in 2020, which claimed the lives of more than 6,500 troops on both sides, ended with a Russian brokered deal that saw Yerevan cede swathes of territory that it had controlled for several decades. Last month, 286 people from both sides were killed in the flare-up of new clashes.
Moscow's task is to find ground for compromise. The interference of Turkey, France, Britain and the United States in the Armenian-Azerbaijani relations in recent months, the so-called Western Peace Project may simply threaten the disappearance of Nagorno-Karabakh. Most experts believe the mediation of such countries is a trap from which there is no way out. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
A refugee center in Sevastopol, Crimea, Most people here have come from Kherson, a Russian-controlled city now under attack by Ukraine.
I wanted to leave Kherson because it was dangerous there. Ukrainian troops are shooting at civilians. Artillery strikes and rockets are coming from the Ukrainian side. They attack both civilian and military objects. They shell our villages, they destroy our homes and kill children.
She can't hold back the tears.
If there is any connection, I call my friends who are staying in a basement. They tell us stories. A 5-story building was shelled and people hear moaning from the rubble. When people tried to rescue them, snipers killed the person who was trying to help and others ran away. Snipers are working everywhere. There was a couple working at the meat factory and the woman was pregnant. The snipers shot both of them in the back. It is Ukraine that does this. The people who remain are considered to be separatists by Ukraine.
Now, many of the people here are scared of Ukrainian reprisals. I've even met an elderly couple here. They're on the Ukrainian kill list, Mirot Verets. Why? Because they're doctors and working in a civilian hospital in Kherson, and they are viewed as Russian collaborators just for doing so.
Roughly 70% of the people in Kherson were pro-Russian and 30% were pro-Ukrainian. The evacuation took place very peacefully and quietly because it came before the military activities began. I have no complaints about the evacuation. The city might be slightly destroyed, but what is more important is that it stays in our hands and victory will be ours.
While pro-Ukrainians may dispute her percentage claim, with Russia forcibly evacuating tens of thousands of civilians from the city, they are now turning it into a fortress, with less risk of either side killing civilians.
Some refugees signed papers to receive financial support. Then they returned 2 weeks later and asked for psychological help. Some people adapt easily, but later they need to talk it out. Some need work immediately, but others need cultural activities to forget the past life and switch to normal life in Sevastopol.
A map in the office. The four regions now claimed by Russia has been colored in with a highlighter. How much more or less will be painted pink will be decided in the coming months, perhaps even years. Meanwhile, it is civilians on both sides of the battle lines who continue to be killed or have their lives turned to turmoil. Johnny Miller, Sevastopol, Crimea.
Importing liquefied natural gas from the US is costing the EU a fortune, and leaders across the 27-nation bloc are looking for a better deal. EU trade ministers met on Monday. They are also not happy with Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act. It includes state aid for American manufacturers that will put EU car builders at a disadvantage.
I will be pretty frank. I think in the form how it was presented, I think for the European Union is unacceptable.
This is all happening due to Western sanctions against Russia. Inflation is out of control. We've asked the European Commission why it's not trying to broker peace between Russia and Ukraine.
It just seems to be not on the agenda at all. Am I completely off the mark in that regard?
We have always said that whoever can use its influence to stop the war in Russia and to stop the war in Ukraine, we will support this.
EU trade ministers accuse Russia of using food as a weapon after Moscow left a UN-negotiated deal to facilitate grain shipments from Ukraine. It follows drone attacks on Russia's Black Sea fleet near Sevastopol on Saturday. The Kremlin blames Kiev, helped by British experts. Eurozone inflation has climbed to a new record high of 10.7%. EU leaders are being urged to tackle a growing social crisis in the bloc.
It is in the hand of the decision makers because it is very easy to solve this problem. And it is a shame for the European Union and for the member states.
Many claim the West could have prevented the war in Ukraine by listening to Russia's security concerns surrounding the issue of NATO expansion. Massive public protests are forecast as wages in the EU fail to keep up with soaring inflation. Already here in Belgium, police have agreed to hold a one-day strike on the 9th of November. The country's firefighters have announced they will do the same in December. A date for that has yet to be announced. It's set to be a winter of discontent for EU governments. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Hey,
History repeats itself once more in Lebanon as President Michel Aoun steps out of a presidential palace, which will remain vacant for an unknown period of time. Addressing flocks of supporters, Aoun said a chapter has ended in Lebanon's politics and a new chapter will begin.
A new phase begins, and this new phase requires struggle and work to exit our crises. The country is looted, and we have to carry out a lot of efforts to uproot corruption.
Aoun talked about the recent agreement with Israel to demarcate Lebanon's maritime borders. He said the deal secured the nation's access to its natural resources, adding that the future revenues should be used to repair the Lebanese economy.
The demarcation of our maritime border will allow us to extract the national treasure of petrol and gas, which would grant us the needed capital to come out of our economic and financial crisis. We hope to see a sovereign fund that would be used for development and also for the upcoming generations.
Aoun took office in 2016. His was marred by mass protests, a severe economic crisis, and currency collapse, and the August 2020 portside blast that killed hundreds.
President Michel Aoun ends his term today at a time when Lebanon is deeply divided on various issues. But it was this term that has given Lebanon what experts are calling a golden opportunity to become a gas exporter and salvage its economy.
President Aoun does not only leave behind a country without a head of state, but he goes back to his residency. The political divide remains quite entrenched, and experts see that the maritime border deal proves that the West has lifted its undeclared blockade on Lebanon.
In Lebanon, we are not usually good at seizing opportunities, but we benefited from the opportunity of demarcating the maritime border. Since there was a Western interest in having a stability in the Mediterranean region and allowing Lebanon to extract its resources. But will the Lebanese seize this opportunity to form an agreement which could result in the election of a president? We are waiting for the upcoming hours, which could evolve into security threats or perhaps surprises.
Lebanese lawmakers have failed to agree on electing a successor for Aoun, with no side having a clear majority to impose a candidate to succeed him. A caretaker government has been in place since the parliamentary elections last spring, and with no hope in forming a new cabinet in the last hours of Aoun's term, political divisions are expected to deepen until the election of a new president. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
In the United States, prosecutors have accused the Trump Organization of greed and cheating in a tax fraud trial. Lawyers have argued the Trump Organization paid an executive $1.76 million through perks such as a free apartment and a leased car. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. For years, as Donald Trump was soaring from reality TV star to the White House, his real estate empire was bankrolling big luxury perks for some of his top executives. Now, Donald Trump's company, the Trump Organization, is on trial for criminal tax fraud. On the hook for what prosecutors say was a 15-year scheme by his most trusted lieutenant to avoid paying taxes on those fringe benefits. The seminal trial in New York got truly underway on Monday, 31st of October, with prosecutors arguing that the company fraudulently evaded tax by paying a key executive $1.76 million through such perks as a free apartment, a leased Mercedes car, and tuition fees for his grandchildren. The case could land the Trump Organization's sprawl of 500 business entities with a criminal conviction that will make it harder for the former president's company to do business. It could also be hit with a $1 million fine. This case is about greed and cheating on taxes, prosecutor Susan Hoffinger said during an opening statement as the Manhattan District Attorney's Office began to build its case. The court will hear from key former executive and prosecution witness Alan Weisselberg, the former chief financial officer, CFO, at the Trump Organization, who has separately already pled guilty to 15 counts of tax fraud. Susan Hoffinger said that evidence would show that Alan Weisselberg's fraud implicates the Trump corporations, the Trump Organization, and Trump Payroll Corps. From 2005 through to 2017, when most of the criminal conduct occurred, the prosecutor noted, these companies were owned by Donald Trump. We all know that corporations aren't people. They can't think or act on their own, Susan Hoffinger argued. But even after Donald Trump was inaugurated as president in 2017 and the companies placed in a trust, she said, they were still effectively owned by Donald Trump. It was only then that the companies finally had to clean up these fraudulent tax practices. But defense attorneys for the Trump Organization asserted that blame for Alan Weisselberg's tax fraud lay solely with him. Trump Organization lawyer Susan Neschels told the jury that the fraud scheme started with Weisselberg and it ended with Alan Weisselberg. So when the prosecutor said the Trump Organization did something illegal for Alan Weisselberg, what they really mean is that Alan Weisselberg did something illegal, Neschels said. The evidence will show the prosecutor's entire theory of the case makes no sense. Michael van der Veen, a personal injury lawyer representing Trump Payroll, was a member of Donald Trump's defense during his historic second impeachment trial for inciting the 6th of January 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, when extremist supporters wanted to overturn the certification of his loss to Joe Biden. On Monday, Michael van der Veen argued that Alan Weisselberg had betrayed the Trump companies. He was trusted by everyone. He was trusted to protect this company, Michael van der Veen said. He was like family to the Trump family, and no employee was trusted more than him. But he made mistakes. The case, one of three Trump-related hearings before the state judges in three New York courthouses this week, is the first relating to the former president's businesses to come to trial since he left office. A separate civil case, which names Donald Trump, his three eldest children, and the Trump Organization in a sprawling indictment alleging significant fraudulent and illegal business activity, has been brought by New York Attorney General Letitia James. Alan Weisselberg only agreed to testify as part of his plea deal. He's not formally a cooperating witness. Judge Juan Manuel Merchan anticipates the trial will last for 4 weeks. A hearing is due in the pending civil fraud trial brought by the Attorney General, and in another case, jury selection began in a civil case brought by protesters who say they were assaulted by security guards outside of the Trump Tower. Separately, Donald Trump petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday, 31st of October, to block Congress from gaining access to his tax returns. Reuters news agency has more for us on the same story. Former President Donald Trump's real estate company cheated tax authorities for 15 years, a prosecutor said on Monday, 31st of October, in her opening statement in the Trump Organization's criminal tax fraud case. While defense lawyers countered that the company's longtime chief financial officer had acted for his own benefit. The company paid certain executives, including former chief financial officer Alan Weisselberg, in perks such as rent and cars, without reporting those benefits to tax authorities, and falsely reported bonuses as non-employee compensation, said prosecutor Susan Hoffinger of the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. This case is about greed and cheating on taxes, Hoffinger said. The scheme was conducted, directed, and authorized at the highest levels of the accounting department at the company. The case is one of several legal troubles facing the 76-year-old Donald Trump as he considers another bid for the presidency after losing in 2020. Donald Trump has not been charged in this case. Alan Weisselberg, who has worked for Trump for nearly half a century, in August pleaded guilty to avoiding taxes on $1.76 million in personal income, and agreed to testify at trial as part of a plea deal for him to receive a sentence of 5 months in jail. He paid back nearly $2 million in taxes, in penalties and in interest, Susan Hoffinger said. Both Trump Organization units charged the Trump Corporation and the Trump Payroll Corporation have pleaded not guilty. Their lawyers argued on Monday that Alan Weisselberg was not acting on the company's behalf. Weisselberg did it for Weisselberg, Michael van der Veen, a lawyer for the Trump Payroll Corporation, said in his opening statement at the trial. Greed made him cheat on his taxes, hide his deeds from his employer, and betray the trust built over nearly half a century. Susan Hoffinger said Weisselberg was a prime beneficiary of the scheme, but she said he acted as a Trump Organization executive and that the company benefited by keeping top executives happy and saving on taxes. Susan Hoffinger said Donald Trump paid for the private school tuition of Alan Weisselberg's grandchildren, adding that the jury would see checks signed by Donald Trump himself as evidence during the trial. Michael van der Veen sought to shift blame to accounting firm Mazars, which handled the company and Alan Weisselberg's tax returns. Mazars did not immediately respond to a request for comment. In February, the firm dropped the Trump Organization as a client and said financial statements it prepared for the company from 2011 through to 2020 should no longer be relied on. If convicted, the Trump Organization, which operates hotels, golf courses, and other real estate around the world, could face $1.6 million in fines. It could also further complicate the real estate firm's ability to do business in America. The trial is expected to last over a month. 12 jurors must reach a unanimous verdict for conviction on each count of tax fraud, scheming to defraud the government, and falsifying business records. She said that when Donald Trump was elected president in late 2016, Alan Weisselberg and the company had to clean up these fraudulent tax practices due to concerns about additional security. The company stopped paying for its employees' unreported personal expenses, and Alan Weisselberg began paying his grandchildren's tuition himself, according to Susan Hoffinger.
This Monday. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Chinese President Xi Jinping has been picked as the party's general secretary for a third time, which means that he will be the leader of China for another 5 years. In the 20th National Congress, the CPC, or Communist Party of China, highlighted its commitments to things like reducing inequality. That's a good cause. When it comes to hot-button issues like Taiwan, we refuse to rule out the possibility of using force. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why China, or what China is going to do for the next 5 years and how that matters, especially at this point in time when the specter of the U.S. provoking it and drawing it into a war over a host of issues stands tall. Let me first introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Joining us from Geneva is Peter Koenig. He's a geopolitical analyst and former World Bank economist. Welcome, Peter Koenig. And also we have from Detroit, Michigan, Haz Aldeen joining us. He's a political analyst and host of Infrared Show.
Is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to the Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Peter Koenig, first I'll start with you. When we take a look at this next 5 years for Xi Jinping to have been picked, it's a good thing in terms of the commitments that he has given, in terms of things that he said he's going to cover, not only on the world scale but also domestically. But the way that the news is covered by some Western or many Western media outlets is he's holding on to power, extending his grip on power, surrounding himself with loyalists. Why do you think their take is different than the substance itself?
Thank you very much for having me. Well, I also think the re-election is a very good thing. It lends the country to more stability and the continuity with the successful policy that he has certainly had in the past. We can talk about those too. I mean, what he has achieved. Now, the Western media, of course, and politicians, they have to criticize, they have to leave no good thing on China. So, but look at Madame Merkel, Germany's chancellor. She was in power for 16 years, was so-called re-elected four times, and nobody complained. The West applies different standards for what it perceives to be itself and her enemies. Now, the other thing that is also largely criticized, as you pointed out, that Xi Jinping surrounded himself with loyalists. Well, tell me one leader, including the U.S. and all of the Europeans and probably around the world, who doesn't set up a cabinet or a series of advisors that are not loyalists. I mean, this is normal. Any president does that, but why is it not correct if China does it? These are double standards, which I think we have to point out to the world and particularly to the media. So this is my take on these two issues. Now, if you like me to go into the achievements,
no, that's okay. We'll get into hopefully some of the areas that you deem also important on this. Hazeldine, I'm going to go to a couple, or really, I should say, one topic that seems to be one of the focus of this of the agenda of Xi Jinping for the next 5 years, and based on what has been covered in his speech, bolstering security and turning China into a technological power is very important for China. Now, we're going to get into technological aspect of it a little later, but national security, high on the agenda and a priority. Why do you think that's cited as a priority in the eyes of Xi Jinping?
Well, as China has entered a new phase of its historical development, which is moving out of the primary stage of modernization and industrialization that characterized the reform and opening up era, China is starting to be recognized around the world as a serious geopolitical player and superpower. And with that has come the understanding on part of the Chinese leadership that that's going to lead to an increased level of aggression and hostility from the world's premier superpower, which is the United States. So China has to prioritize national security now in ways that it wasn't before, because it is increasingly finding itself in the crosshairs of the State Department and the foreign policy agenda of the United States.
National security and then technology. Peter Koenig, those two have been covered out of this conference synonymously at the same time. And it's very interesting, the reason for that, which based on just some of the research done, it seems like the technological aspect is somewhat tied into what the U.S. has done recently when it comes to the issue of chips. We know that they've restricted access to the Chinese when it comes to chips. Chips that, we know that they're for everyday appliances practically these days, but more importantly, it's used in the military arena. And the conclusion is that the U.S. is trying to prevent China from advancing in that field. Why do you think the U.S. wants to prevent China from advancing in that field?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure this can be taken seriously. I think this is more Biden's or the U.S. administration's bluff vis-a-vis the rest of the world. China is very much advanced in technology, in chip technology, and so on. China has almost all, if not all, of the raw materials, which means the rare earths that are needed for these technological approaches. So China has the capacity to be on its own, and that's why I wonder what is behind that. Of course, China needs to build up its military, and that is very clear. You pointed it out. You pointed out the reasons, and I agree with them. Especially, I mean, there is more going on. There's NATO encroaching on China from all sides, particularly the South China Sea. And conflicts are brewing everywhere in order to restrain China. So it is very logical that China has to build up, and does, has been doing so for the past 2 years. Its army and its technological advances in the military, while maintaining, and I would like to stress that, while maintaining a peaceful approach to what they call the modernization of China, actually the new direction that they're going into by reaching out to the global south. But as far as the U.S. so-called sanctions is concerned, they sound and read like terrific. I mean, I think Biden has threatened U.S. citizens or technological experts in China, if they don't quit their jobs immediately, they lose their nationality. So what? I mean, China has the technology themselves to continue working on it. They also have, as I said, the raw materials. Uh-huh. So I'm not so sure whether this is a real threat or just bluff.
Well, based on the reports, it is a real threat. And it's interesting that you talk about rare earths, because Hazeldine, China is not going to rule out not giving rare earths to the U.S., which would be a big catastrophe for the U.S. Exactly. In terms of the materials that are used that contain rare earths. But the mere fact that the U.S. wants to stop the advancement of another country in order for it to try to speed itself up and catch up, I guess that's one reason why the U.S. would do that. Or are we looking at the fact that China has passed the threshold in U.S.'s eyes when it comes to military prowess and strength, when it comes to hot-button issues, for example, Taiwan, which China has not ruled out using military force in terms of reunification? Of course, the U.S. has said we will defend Taiwan at the same time.
Well, I think
I'm sorry, Peter Koenig. This is for Hazeldine. Sorry, I'll get to you. Hazeldine, go ahead.
Yes, I think it speaks more to the more fundamental level of modernization and development of the productive forces that China has achieved, where now it's the United States which has to catch up with China. But the difference is, of course, that there was a time in which China felt like it had to catch up with the advanced countries and the Western world, and it did so by peaceful economic means, maneuvering its way through the complicated, you know, geopolitical and global political situation. The United States, in its attempt to catch up with China's level of not only technological advancement, but access to raw materials and resources and supply chains, can only do what it knows best and use political military force, rather than find some kind of cunning manner in the same way that China did to maneuver its way into catching up with China. The United States has to, I guess, achieve its economic goals at the barrel of a gun. And what it really speaks to as far as the United States' need to put China down and prevent China's development and growth is it's part and parcel with the United States' strategy, at least for the past few decades. The U.S. used to be the leader of global economic development, supposedly after the Bretton Woods period. Now the United States only seems like it can maintain its monopolistic position by directly halting and forestalling the development of other countries, whether it's through the IMF and their predatory loans, or through the use of military force to prevent other regional currencies from emerging, as we saw in the Middle East.
Well, Peter Koenig, in order to wrap our heads around what the U.S. wants to do with China, the facts should actually dictate the way we should see things. And that is, when you take a look at the way that China provides the types of goods that it does to countries around the world, it seems like it would just be very close to impossible for it to be taken out. Can't help but reflect on what the EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell actually stated on October 10th, saying that the EU prospered because it got cheap gas from Russia and it was able to get the cheap labor and goods from China, and it was able to prosper. So doesn't the U.S. approach towards China mean that it's going to hit a dead end? And also, at what cost? And of course, how China is going to react to U.S. aggression?
Well, yes, it's obvious. I mean that China has been for the last how many 20 years or maybe even more, a growing competition for the U.S. hegemony, and that is of course not acceptable for the U.S. Economy. I mean, the U.S. economy basically right now they can't supply anything that is competitive. Not even replacement energy to the European Union after having forced them to cut off the gas stream from Russia. I mean, this is asking the European Union to commit suicide, which they obviously are ready to do. But on the larger scale, it's true. Of course, the U.S. cannot compete with anything that comes from China, and I think this is the long term. This is the threat and the long term fear that the U.S. has, that there will be eventually a unification of Eurasia, and Eurasia includes. I mean, it's the hugest continent of our Mother Earth. That would include about two-thirds of the world population, and China, Russia, India, and Pakistan, and all these countries are going to be part of it. And so, if this happens, I mean, that's a logical step because it's an non-interrupted area that would be economically so strong that there would be no other empire that could survive. And this is, I guess, the long-term threat that the U.S. perceives and wants to abolish, do away with Russia, and then as a next step or simultaneously China. That's where they why they're encroaching on both of these countries. Sure. So it's very clear, yes, the European Union, of course, itself could be a threat because they have 500 million people, they have a well-running economy, and if all countries, all the 27 countries would put their economic output together, they would have a larger GDP than the one of the U.S. And that's why the European Union was never allowed to become a federation, like a one-country federation like the United States of America.
Sure.
So this is very clearly the reason behind it.
Well, of course, the U.S. is trying everything it can in order to get the U.S. I'm sorry, get the European companies onto U.S. soil with the type of energy deals that it's offering, moving towards green energy. But Hazeldine, the South China Sea is another topic that China needs to deal with when it concerns the U.S. because the U.S. is in China's backyard and is trying to maneuver itself and get other countries in that region behind it. Now, the big question is, Xi Jinping obviously realizes that, and conveniently, Xi Jinping is also the leader of the military of China. So, conveniently, he can direct that approach, the militaristic approach, if required. Do you think that in his vision, after being reelected for the next 5 years, that that's on his agenda and something he's going to act on, given the fact that the U.S. will act on its aggression, which all signs are pointing to that?
Yes, I think China, while ramping up its military capabilities, is going to maintain a fundamentally defensive position. I don't think China has any ambitions to tip the scales in any drastic manner itself, though I do think it's preparing for the United States to act rashly, whether in the South China Sea or elsewhere. And I think that's really the linchpin of China's overall geopolitical and military strategy here. They're not necessarily looking to start any kind of conflict or fight, but they're definitely preparing and perhaps even expecting the United States to initiate one.
Okay, so when you say that, it's interesting because let's just dial back in time and go back to a month or so ago, where in a span of, I think, a week or 2 weeks, you had all these U.S. officials visiting the island. The most notable one was Nancy Pelosi, which in the beginning, there were speculations as to why she would go, because she would be next in line if something were to happen to Joe Biden after the VP, of course. But then we saw all these trips by U.S. officials. That was intense provocation. And we saw with China, how China reacted. And it was the military posturing that China took. So when you say that, that goes against what we just saw happen during that past weeks. So do you still think that that would be the case, the defensive posture? Because that speaks of an old China. Maybe the new China in the next 5 years is not going to be like that.
Well, it should be. Oh, I don't know.
Okay, go ahead. Peter Koenig, to you.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Sorry, Hazeldine. I'll get to you, though. Go ahead, Peter Koenig.
All right. What I think is happening, and I think President Xi was very clear on that, that he says he plans to peacefully integrate Taiwan into the mainland of China, and accent on peacefully. That is a priority because it's an internal affair. However, what he also said, that if there is foreign intervention in this process, then China would use the military. And I think this is very, very clear, and it's also very difficult from the south. From the South China Sea, where the South China Sea is a very largely disputed territory and disputed mostly by the U.S. because they want to encroach on China from all ends. And there it could be very different. That China is putting up military bases on some of the islands, which it controls or pretends to control, and there the situation may be different. But I think, fundamentally, I agree with my colleague. I don't think they changed their posture of becoming aggressive, but rather defensive, but being better prepared for such a defense than they have been maybe henceforth.
So what is the threshold, though? Tell us, if you can tell us, what line would the U.S. cross when it comes to, let's say, Taiwan, that it would require a reaction from China?
Okay. Well, I think that threshold or red line has been made very clear. If Biden has said they will defend Taiwan at any time, if there's an active intervention in the case of, and I think that has already started, maybe clandestinely, not open to the public, sort of negotiations between Taiwan and mainland China. If there is an active intervention in this process by the U.S. or by anybody, by a proxy from Europe or somewhere else, then I think that would be the red line for China's military to intervene.
I see. So, Hazeldin, the economy obviously is something that China needs to deal with when it comes to not only the world, but also, of course, the U.S. that is trying to put a stick in the wheel, so to speak. Interestingly, when China rolled out the Belt and Road Initiative years and years ago, the U.S. did nothing really, but it came out through the G7 and offered its version of something to, I guess, counter the Belt and Road Initiative. It's called the Partnership for Global Infrastructure Investment. I don't know if you've heard of it, to mobilize $600 billion for middle and low-income countries.
Yes.
Well, it didn't really take off, Hazeldin. It hasn't really gone anywhere. And now we've gone through COVID and now, of course, the Ukraine conflict. Do you think that was a very unsuccessful and big and significant failure on the part of the G7 to stand up to China's Belt and Road Initiative?
Oh, I mean, undoubtedly. You know, the devil is always in the details. I have no doubt that the United States and its so-called allies can commit as much money as they want to kind of try and rival China's Belt and Road Initiative. But what they don't have is the more overreaching strategy, as well as the details about which companies are going to be building this infrastructure, how are they going to do it, and where are they going to do it. I don't see that global vision on part of the United States that can rival China's as far as what it expects in terms of increasing global economic interconnectedness, mobilizing using China's most intricate levels of economic planning, state-owned enterprises and infrastructure companies in partnership with other countries and governments. I think what the United States really lacks in that department is a solid level of win-win diplomacy, mutual understanding between partners rather than one domineering empire giving orders and commands to others. And even regardless, China has already, if I recall correctly, committed some $900 billion to the Belt and Road Initiative since it began in around 2013. So even then, if the United States has any intention of trying to rival China's Belt and Road Initiative, it's going to have to deal with two realities. First, it's going to have to dismantle the special relationships China has cultivated with its partners in the Belt and Road Initiative and somehow replace them. And then second, it's going to actually have to catch up in terms of, you know, reaching the level of progress that China has already since 2013. And given the state of economic crisis now plaguing the United States, and the internal political crisis within the United States, I just find that highly unrealistic.
Thank you. Thank you for that. We're fresh out of time. Peter Koenig, geopolitical analyst and former World Bank economist from Geneva. Hazeldin, thank you, political analyst and host at the Infrared Show from Detroit, Michigan. And with that, we come to an end.